Hey everybody, this is Clean Cut Casual, the bi-weekly podcast about board games, card games, and tabletop games. I'm Ethan Schultz, the podcast moderator and editor. Along with me tonight are three friends who we just finished a game of Space Cadets, which we'll be discussing tonight. If you guys want to go ahead and introduce yourselves, starting with Creepy Chris.
What's going on, world? I'm Chris, a.k.a. Creepy Chris.
My name is John.
And my name is Andrew.
So we're going to go ahead and jump right off the bat to apologize for our late delay on posting a podcast. We've kind of been a little lazy recently. Chris has been dealing with some work issues, and I've been in New York. And then Ryan, of course,
is missing in action.
We have no idea where the hell he is. So we're going to go ahead and just jump right into it with a review of Space Cadets, followed by a discussion about miniature games, which we've been playing a hell ton of War Machine lately, so probably majority of it we'll be discussing that.
And Mercs,
for those of us who have not funded into playing that game yet. And then following that, we are going to be discussing the March 30th date of the first ever International Tabletop Day.
So, yeah.
On that note, let's dive right into Space Cadets. A game of Space Cadets. Space Cadets is made by Stronghold Games. It's a fun and frantic cooperative game for 3 to 6 players who take the roles of bridge officers on a starship. Each officer must accomplish his specific task in order for the team to successfully complete the mission. How do you guys feel about this game so far today?
Well, it was crazy fun. I emphasize the crazy in the fact that you're basically timed. I mean, you have time limit in the game, about 30 seconds for each person to do their individual task, and can get pretty hectic, especially when you have multiple enemies on the board. But
I thought it was a really fun game. One thing I almost felt like it wasn't like nerfed in the sense that it came into steps. You right in the beginning of it, the moment you made your first initial move, it was hard characters. Like, yeah. Things were really, really well stacked against you.
On that note, might I add, Chris and I have played this game twice, and so far we've never gotten past the first tile flopped on the board.
Yeah.
And this was John and ours first time too. Right. So.
Yeah.
Right. Space Cadets is actually pretty good. It's a game that's played with 3 to 6 players. It takes about 60 to 120 minutes. The closest thing I can put it to would be Space Alert, which I believe we've talked about a few times on the podcast. Space Alert is like 10 minutes long, but what you're doing is so chaotic, and one bad maneuver can ruin the entire game, which is kind of about the same for Space Cadets. Space Cadets has a sequence of action turns, which I'll read them right now, which is on the captain sheet. You get to discuss and distribute energy, which is about a 3-minute discussion you can do. After that, you get to do prepare the stations, which is prepare all 6 stations that are on the table. Then you do an action phase, which is 3A, which is doing half of the actions for the entire bridge, and then you do the last 3. Then you get a resolution phase, and then you get to try to do a tractor beam, which is how you pretty much win the game. You need to get 3 crystals, right?
Correct. So well, in some of the missions. Some of the missions, it's just a search and destroy.
Oh, search and destroy would be sweet. We've been trying to get crystals, 3. We have not gotten any in either one of the games.
So we got one in the first game we played, but we died immediately afterwards.
And we probably played that completely wrong. Action 5 would be, or action 6 is fire weapons. 7 is enemy action, which is awful. 7 is jump, which is how you'd actually end the game. And then 9 is repair if you didn't leave space. And repairing is a crucial aspect of the game. I think we'll break down what each little bridge does in a minute. But overall, the game is super fun, really co-op. You really need to discuss. It's intense because you only have about 30 seconds in each phase and just a 3-minute discussion at the beginning to prepare.
Might I also add, though, we're actually referencing the captain sheet from the 3 to 4 player side. We haven't had the opportunity yet to play this game for 5 to 6 players, just from finding people to play who are willing to sit down for an hour and a half and try and learn a relatively complex game with a relatively difficult instruction manual. But
yes,
due to the fact that this setup has like a 3A and a 3B setup, most people in a 4 or less player game are usually managing 2 stations at once, which can, even though they happen at different times, can be a little mind-boggling. Like, even at the captain step, you're like dealing with the tractor beam or not doing the tractor beam, like what was happening in the last game. Or you're also doing engineering, trying to pump a bunch of shields out when you're not drawing any tiles with shields. So it can be a little frustrating. I feel like especially during the prepare station steps that usually happen before each of the main like tier events of tasks, you really need to kind of like sit and like take some deep breaths and kind of like go outside, smoke a cigarette, go to the bathroom, and kind of like chill out, because we're so like mentally drained from just the 3 minutes of discussing and setting it up.
Yeah, I think the best part of this game, honestly, is probably each bridge is so crucial to each other that messing up once is devastating. And I think the downside of the game is sensors and movement happens at the same time. And that's like the crucial way of how to not take damage or take a shit ton of damage, which is a plus or a minus depending on what happens to you. Because movement is a little random, which I think we'll get into in a minute or two. Same with sensors. But overall, if you like games that are probably, I would say probably about 80% you're going to lose the game, which is Ghost Stories,
100%.
Several others. So if you want a challenging game with a good group that can discuss, talk, be socially open,
it's an appealing game in the fact that you're just bonding with everybody.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We'll break that down.
Yeah. So as Clint intercepted from outside of the podcast table, each particular station you're working in is actually pretty much playing its own separate mini game, which it's an interesting element that I haven't really seen in any other games that have been made recently. So it definitely made the game extremely, extremely interesting, because one player is playing shuffleboard while one's playing memory, and then the person who's in charge of repairs is flipping down cards when we take damage, that's flipping the memory board upside down. Like, there's so much synergy in between each of the different stations, which are doing entirely different minigames in themselves at the same time while we're all cursing and yelling at each other.
Yeah.
So it creates a really weird synergy for a cooperative game when no one's really playing the same game inside of the same game. I don't know. How do you feel about that, Tom?
I think it's interesting. I'm going to jump onto one thing really quick. My only disregard with this game, my only actual dislike with this game is twofold. It's one, it's a really long game, which is cool in the aspect of, you know, it's fun to play it for a while if you enjoy the game. But if you're getting your butt kicked the entire time, the game just drags.
Yeah, well, to insert into that, though, yeah. I mean, we probably played, what, hour and a half, maybe? Hour and a half earlier?
Yeah.
I mean, while that seems long, John,
this is
coming from Chris and I, who spent 4 hours playing Middle-Earth
Quest. Lord of the Rings is where I very new in the game. Like, I've only been playing games for about a month. And then the second thing was 6 people.
Yeah.
Like, trying to get 6 people down to play a game, even at a gaming store on a random Wednesday, sometimes can be next to impossible.
It's on top of that fact of the length of the game. Like,
exactly.
Getting 6 people to sit down for an hour and a half game that requires so much upfront questions and answers and teaching, and like the fact is, like, even when Chris and I sat down to teach you two how to play, it was like we kind of had to be like, all right, this is what this one does, this is what this one does, this is how this one works, this is how it works. So it's like you kind of get an idea of how your station works, but you can't really go into it and be like, oh, well, this one works this way and works with the sensors like this, and then it works with the shields this way. Like,
but that brings up an interesting point then, because then this game, I'm looking at the rule book right now, and this is small type, big rule book.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's 30 pages, I'd say.
But it's all like 10-point font.
And not very well written.
Yeah. Stronghold, you make cool games, but Jesus, learn how to write your
Stronghold. Yeah, I think I've only had someone get Stronghold game.
My point of what I'm saying is this is a game, if you're going to get into this game, be with somebody who's played it before.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Don't try
it when it's new.
Don't buy it brand new and expect to be able to play it and get everything right.
Well, it took us 4 hours to play a first game.
Yeah. I will be the one to put it out there as in, I will spend money for someone to create a new instruction manual that explains it a lot better than this one.
Exactly.
Or if there's an FAQ on Stronghold, we hope there is, please.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think we also had some points, even when you guys knew the game, that we were having some issues within the game, that we were messing up things, and you know, we realized like halfway through we were messing up the repair sections, for instance. And, you know, I think it would really require someone to sit down, do a few practice games by themselves or with another person, and just, you know, figure all the nuances. Then,
well, this is one game I don't think you can practice by yourself. Like, you could practice a section.
Yeah.
They get really good, but if you tried to play the whole component of the game and playing all six, it just wouldn't happen for you.
Well, you almost have to sit and spend time considering. Like, I feel like, because I guess, to put it in brief, the two games that we played, whenever we started it, the first thing we did was like, all right, we started on tile one, we're sector scanning the next one. And I almost feel like hang out on the first tile and like just prepare everybody to go into the next one. Like,
all right, energy's
in the right place, let's go with it, you know? Yeah. Like, because like every time we dove right in, like sure enough, we got scanned by an enemy ship and we already had the shit getting beaten out of us in a matter of minutes.
Exactly.
And there is a learning curve to every game. Usually, typically, when you're learning a game, you're going to add 45 minutes to the game, no matter what game you're playing. When it's your first time, you know, it's going to be a little longer. Once you get the rules down and get everything down, what the box says is probably more accurate. I think the first few games would be less than 60 minutes because we did mess up on repairs and how damage works.
Yeah.
And
the instruction manual didn't really elaborate too effectively on how it really
does.
Neither
does it have an icon or a very good glossary, but hey, whatever. It's Stronghold Games. They make fun, silly games that are really thematic and just awesome. So.
Yeah.
Well, that raises the question then, right in there, where you were talking about how you need to add the 45 minutes. Would this be a game that you would play twice? So, for instance, if you bought this game, we played it the way we played it, would you really be quick to devote another hour and a half to playing this all over?
Oh, yeah. Hands down.
Even though we got the shit beat out of us, it's probably one of the more fun games that I'm happy I've spent money on purchasing as like a spur of the moment buy.
But why is that? Why? What about this game made it to where you would want to play this again?
It's got unique components to it.
It's
got a definitely cool new feel to a game. And the luxury with us, since it's six players, you're like, when are you ever going to get six players? Well, for Clean Cut Casual, we have about five regular people that we always play with.
Right.
So finding six, honestly, isn't too hard for us. But this is definitely a game you would want to plan an evening for, not just, hey, we're going to be at the shop. Six people want to play this game? Since it's a longer game, this is something definitely you would want to set up beforehand and be like, hey, this is the game we want to play.
Well,
we need to come.
It's like the suggestion I made to you the first time we were playing after we finished. I was like, man, like a good idea would have been like, get a hold of everybody, be like, hey, these are the stations that you're running, and then have that person go home to Stronghold before the day that they play and actually watch the Stronghold videos. Like, this is how the engineer works, this is how the damage works. Mm-hmm. Even though they don't describe the damage, they describe how the station works, but not that effectively.
I think the other part that brings this game like to want to play it on the table again is a lot of new gamers would rather play a co-op game than a complete just dick you game.
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh, sweet, we're all working together, sweet, so I'm not going to just instantly lose and not know how to play the game. Everyone's learning.
Branching off that, that's actually what got me into board games altogether, was Shadows Over Camelot co-op, Zombicide co-op, and even this one. I want to pick this game up again for two reasons, co-op and the mini games.
Yeah.
The fact that you're playing shuffleboard in a board game
and Tetris
doing terrible.
And
Tetris.
Like a poker version.
And poker.
There's poker.
Yeah.
There's Tetris, there's memory.
Yeah, there's a memory aspect to it. There's Yahtzee.
Yeah, practically Yahtzee.
There's a lot, man. Like, it's just
Tetris.
All in it, it almost is like it brings your childhood into an adult board game.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think for the theme, which is probably another point of why I like the game so much, is if we were actually on a spaceship that was getting attacked and we needed to get an objective and get out of there, I think the actual ship would be in a chaotic state of everyone moving to their bridge and actually trying to control everything that's going on. And that's what this game makes it feel like with the 30 seconds, because you're rushing for those puzzles or the memory game or Tetris or bridge or poker, whichever one you're doing, it's still chaotic. And the fun factor, which we still have not yet to see, is core breach, which is...
God, no.
Oh, no.
We got to a point where it was just like, do we want to do the core breach even though we know we're going to die? And we were just like, no, like, we're just going to die.
Core breach is a matching game. And once you go through a damage deck, which I think is about 9 cards, so if you exceed 9 damage in one turn, your core gets breached. Which is, for the first one, everyone would take 3 core breach cards.
Three would be dispersed among the group.
Yes. And they have a picture on them, and then you get a core repair. And within your 30 seconds of doing your normal bridge, you also have to find that matching card for your core repair to the core breach. If all three of you don't find it within that 30 seconds, the ship explodes.
And you automatically lose. That is how the game ends.
Which is chaotic and nuts. Because then, in reality, if you can't find your card, you did nothing on your bridge besides repairing the ship. Which would be hectic if a ship was on, you know, fire or water was going in a submarine. You know, I don't know what actually would happen in space.
Yeah, well, it's, in essence, you're kind of picturing, like, everybody's working at their stations and something catches fire and everybody's like, oh shit, we need to go fix that problem. Like, everybody jumps up at once and goes to, like, you know... I don't know if you use a fire extinguisher in space, but...
I have no clue what you're doing today. I'm assuming, like, it would just be like an airplane, and it opens up bigger and bigger, and everyone just flies out, and you're dead anyway. But,
oh, my gosh.
Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. The backpack off that thematic idea, too. Also, like, all the game pieces are extremely thematic. Like, each of the little paper palettes that each player uses in order to play... appears as, you know, like a glass display, like you were sitting at, you know, your Star Trek desk. That
they
has,
even
like,
have the screws.
What they're showing, they have the screws in the corner. They have faux printed reflection on them.
Captain's got a microphone. Oh no, that's a loose screw. Never mind.
That's a loose screw. Yeah, we're not on the best ship of all.
I have a microphone.
I will say, I wish the components, like the small pieces, are made out of cardboard, standard. You know, I will say the game could improve from having its actual like dashes printed on cardboard, so they're not little loose pieces of.
You can always laminate it.
Yeah, you can laminate.
Laminating's not that expensive.
And I also. I'm almost half tempted to search and find little spaceship miniatures because I feel like the squares you use for the spaceships would look 100 times cooler if they were miniatures.
That's what I was thinking as well.
How much was the game is the real question.
$60-$70
See, for $70,
really?
I want a
nothing
miniature.
But cardboard for
$70? I think it was 60.
I want a miniature. I want better dice.
Maybe it was 50. I don't remember. It was in the 50s.
If it's 50s. It's okay for cardboard, but if it's 60 or 70.
If once you get past 50, you want some plastic. I want better dice. The dice on it were black wood blocks with dots on them,
but they're
basically.
Wood dice.
I like wood dice.
I like wood dice. I like plastic dice better.
And those dice like to roll sixes. I need to start pulling those out and playing War Machine because they are awesome.
I tend to agree with John. I like to have my dice. I like to feel a heft to my dice.
Yeah.
I don't like to feel like it's going to float away on me.
Yeah, exactly. They were really light, too.
Well, I think what they should have done to keep with the theme, I think it should have been custom dice, which would have made the game cost more.
Right.
But they could have made it, I don't know how you would do it, but you could have made, you know, special little icons for each one and made it a custom dice set, which would be a little bit cooler.
Maybe version 2?
So,
version
who knows,
two.
The game did get best of 2, like, one of the top games to be looking for 2012.
I don't know if it physically got rated as a top of 2012, but I know pretty much
I'm
majority
sure
of the other podcasts were, like, a rant and rave that this was
I'm pretty sure it was in the top 20, or just outside of the top 20 for Board Game Geek. But nonetheless, it is a phenomenal game.
Oh, yeah. Currently, right now, on Board Game Geek, it is ranked at 831 with a 7.34 rating out of 10.
And for thematic rank, it's actually at 113.
Which is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
If you can get top 200 on theme, you're awesome. What's
up? Space Cadets actually was, I just looked it up, it's $50. So we're right at that right little even spot there where, you know, it is kind of an inexpensive game in the aspect that you could see it at Walmart. You could see it at different places where...
I'd hope not.
I don't know,
we have our own personal mindset about, like, big retailers picking up games, pulling business away from, you know, small shop owners.
Well, because you look at the retailers, they usually only retail games right around $40 mark. Like, Settlers of Catan just got picked up there.
Yeah.
And that's actually popping up left and right, like Walmart, Target.
Well, I think what they're doing is they're picking the... best-selling games, which are pretty much openers to grasp people into, which I think we talked about that in the first podcast.
Yeah, it was like it's a lead-in game, you know, like someone who goes and picks up Catan from Target might be interested in going to their local store and buying something that's, you know, a little bit more complex or relatively complex, like Space Cadets.
Because I want to say there's only like 5 or 6 board games at actual big retailers, and they're all ones that are in like the top 100 sellers.
But come back to the topic that we're currently discussing. Board Game Geek actually currently lists the game's mechanics as being cooperative play, dice rolling, memory, a modular board, patterns, recognition, press your luck.
That's a big one.
Yeah, press your luck is definitely a really big one. It's in the categories it falls under is an action dexterity puzzle real-time science fiction game that was a really long, that also includes space and exploration, which, you know, who hates space and who hates exploration games, like majority of the games. Actually, I'm not a big fan of space, yet I'm the person who fucking bought the game, so. I just heard really good things. Well, it was really fun.
That shows you that it's a pretty well-designed game.
Actually, it's pretty sad because I'm not a big fan. I'm not going to say I hate. I'm not a big fan of space games, but while I was in New York, those were the only games I bought were space games. I bought Space Cadets, and I bought Cosmic Encounter, which Cosmic Encounter obviously is the shit.
An amazing game.
It's an amazing game.
I will agree with you.
Well, we played Space Cadets earlier today. Each of the four of us had different stations. The stations that I was in charge of maintaining was the captain, the engineering station, and then the tractor beam. So the captain station, more so you're kind of just running the time clock. Captain, you're kind of just controlling the little timer as you flip and kind of making sure everybody sticks on task, and you're also leading the group discussions. The captain also later on in the game is kind of like, I don't want to say the tiebreaker, but he's like the deciding factor when it comes to core breach. It's like if a core breach happens, you're the one who's like, player A gets a core breach, player C gets one, player D, et cetera, et cetera. Along with that, I also played the engineering station, which engineering is pretty much how you create energy for the rest of your stations to use. Through this process, you're actually playing a tile game where you flip the tiles that have either full icons of each station or half icons, and you have to match them up within the 30 seconds to create energy for the other spaces for the following turn. The engineering can get really screwed really quickly, especially when the ship starts taking a lot of damage, because most of the time you can only produce at maximum 3 for one station unless you're willing to sacrifice a ton. And usually once you have a bunch of continuous damage occurring where you're losing or absorbing, as this game calls it, energy, you're pretty much not going to have places that are going to be operating on particular turns. After that, I was also playing the tractor beams, which I didn't really get to do a lot of due to the fact that we had so many continuous damages going on. But the tractor beam you pretty much use in order to either pull enemies closer to get better shots on them, or you also use it to collect the crystals, which some of the missions, that's kind of the main point, what you're trying to hunt down. And that's pretty much a game of memory where you're flipping over on a grid of 25 tiles. It's either 25 or in that range, but you're flipping over tiles that have number quantities and shapes and colors on them, and pretty much whenever you match them, there's a number that you assign to and you add that to the distance that you are from a target, and then it's pretty much like a target roll number you have to try and hit in order to pull something in and collect it. So next we're going to pass it on to Andrew if he wants to go ahead and detail on what he played.
Okay, so I was in charge of the sensors and the shields. And they're pretty self-explanatory. The sensors allowed you to look for enemies, lock on to enemies, examine new sectors, and even had a cloaking device.
Which the cloaking was a big deal.
Yeah, the cloaking was definitely a big deal. I think we only got it off once successfully.
Yes.
Yeah.
But and that allows you to obviously to avoid enemies. The mechanic for that, the little mini game, is you had a bag of tiles, similar to like Tetris pieces, that you could not look into. And you had to match, just by feel, the tile that came up on the card that you put placement on. And if you did not match them in the first time, you did not get that tile. So it was a really kind of interesting, you had to be very dexterous to successfully produce the sensors, and that there were some times where I just did not hit anything. Shields is simply that you had four little locations on the ship where you could put shields, and you played this small, I'm equated to a poker game, in which you would flip up these little tiles, and they each have numbers on them, and your objective was to match, like make a straight, or make two of a kind, three of a kind,
full houses,
that kind of thing, and basically, by matching those amounts, you determine how much of a shield you could do. Now, this was a little difficult, and we found out, because at least in the first turn, you really didn't know where any of the enemies are, where to place the shield, so you basically had to guess. And sometimes, even then, even after you knew where the enemies are, you still had to guess whether you would get some. Sometimes you would not get any shields at all, sometimes you get max shields. And it was more just a kind of a random experience where you could get the best rolls possible and still due to other factors.
The shield is highly dependent on the location of the helm's movement, which we realized very quickly that it's very difficult to kind of plan where the helm is going when you're flipping cards randomly over a deck.
Right.
So most of the time when we're like, oh, go straight, we ended up like driving around in some bastardized.
About the only time that we were ever certain where to place the shields and get them was when we literally had an enemy right next to us who was blowing his lasers into us, and we just had to place them right there. That was about the only time that you could be certain. So both of these sections really required a lot of... One required a lot of skill, and one required a lot of luck. So it was kind of an interesting balance to play both of those sections at the same time. I think I'm going to pass this on to John to list what he got to play.
Well, I had the pleasure of playing the Helm and also the Jump. I'm going to jump onto the Helm really quick. The Helm basically was just the movement. I was the driver of this space exploration. And I didn't get to do much.
Yeah, we kind of had a circumstance where we weren't getting a lot of energy to Helm to really do anything.
Yeah, it was. It ended up with, I think, a good four turns of just no movement whatsoever.
Well, that's because John turned the ship around.
Yeah,
and put our ass in front of the two ships.
It was an accident.
He decided to moon the enemy ships, and they returned in kind.
Yeah, and see, that brings up another concept of how we all need to work together. Because if I would have been able to keep the ship where he had the shields facing those enemies, we would have been a lot better off.
Yeah.
I feel like you also kind of when you play the Helm, you have to be very attentive on what other options you have through the pain causing choices you have. The ones where you can choose to just automatically do it and roll a dice and possibly take damage. Because like sometimes when you're like, oh crap, like I only turn stuff that's going to turn me around, you can be like, all right, I'll take the one damage so my shield's pointing in the right way, rather than being like, oh well, I guess I'll turn around and then get the shit beat out of me by a ship.
Well, what Ethan's referring to is, as we played, I had three decks of cards. Actually, I'm sorry, two decks of cards for the Helm. I had a set of cards that was standard movement. I can move them at any time, but there was a penalty to use those. And then there was a deck of cards where it was a very randomized movement. I could only draw up to how fast the ship could go. So, for instance, if the ship was able to go a movement of two, I could only draw two cards. And these two cards were completely randomized. And then I had to take those two cards, or three cards, or whatever it was going to end up being, and I had to decipher a movement that was beneficial not only to positioning, but also to protection, because the shield placement is before the movement. So this was a very frantic, scary thing, because then I'm trying to decide, well, okay, I can move this way to get away from this stuff, but I'm facing in the wrong direction. But if I take this one point of damage, that's a possible point of damage from these standard movements, then I could place that there to be able to be safer. So the Helm was a lot of fun. Was it easy? Absolutely not. It was freaking hard. On the other hand, though, it was a very fun kind of... It reminded me of that old game. It was called Pipes. Do you guys remember Pipes?
I think I'm obviously too young for Pipes.
Oh, shut up. You're the only one at the fucking table.
I think I know what you're talking about.
Okay, it was a game where basically you were a plumber. Pipes,
oh,
you're a plumber.
Of course you were.
And you had this board. I think it was... it was a 10x10 board, or no, it wasn't 10x10 board. It was about a 5x5 board. So, and then each square was a different pipe shape, and water would move through the board, and you had to twist the pipes to be able to make the water get from one point to another point.
Oh,
so that's kind of what you were playing, which you were given a set of cards, and you're trying to move this ship like you would be moving those pipes. We're trying to turn it and switch it and move it forward a little bit as you're playing these cards. Mm-hmm. So. Playing it, very difficult for the little bit I did. And then when I messed up, I screwed everyone. Everyone got screwed over in it.
Now, to be fair, it was only like one or two times, but those one or two times cost us the game.
Just one time was enough to give us enough damage to completely just screw us.
And it was the first turn.
It's really rough to decide what side of the ship needs to be facing when every tile that we explore reveals two enemies, you know, and when it creates two enemies, it's kind of, it's relatively difficult to be like, well, shit, like, are they both coming at me, my port side, or are they, you know, one's from front, one's from back, you know, is it a double team, triple team, like, you don't even know.
Exactly. Like,
sometimes it's just in the shadows of night, and you just can't understand.
You just don't even know.
Yeah, it just happens.
Well, the other side of the things I've played was Jump. Now, I love Jump. Jump was by far my most favorite of the sector I got to play.
Dice rolling games, man.
Because exactly.
It's a good lead in into talking about miniature war games.
But see, like it was Yahtzee. Straight up, it was Yahtzee, and you had to be able to do quick math. You had to be able to do quick recognition. You had cards that switched your dice up. You had cards that turned odds into evens, ones into sixes, sixes into ones. Added one to each dice.
And created crazy combos. Things cost one less and then changing odds into evens.
Exactly.
Like, oh, sweet.
So, like, it really wasn't very beneficial to the ship at the time. At the end of
the game.
Exactly. At the end of the game, then it was... I almost felt like it was too easy to get jump off. Because all I had to do was two cards, and I had a guaranteed jump every turn. Yeah.
Well, it might have been a good idea to use that if we were in the game longer, to use that blink effect.
Exactly.
I still need to read up the rules on the blink, but if the blink allows you to blink in and out and lose locks, oh, God, that would be totally...
Oh, yeah.
That would be totally...
Plus, you're moving three spaces and turning.
And that would make more sense, because we were getting, you know, even when we tried to escape, there was still... We had enemies that could, you know... Right. Easily lock on us from six or seven spaces away, so we had to move like half the tile, or at least another full tile to escape. So maybe that, maybe that is the solution to our problem that we were having.
Right.
I would like to play again, and my goal would be completely different. I would be going for that guaranteed blink. It was two cards that turn odds into evens and evens into odds. And if you have five dice and you can turn any odd into an even and even any even into an odd, you have an infinite combo there. Where you can just continuously pick any dice. So I can say, okay, now all these are all fives.
Right, which receiving those are really difficult, because I think you need four of one number. One is ones, twos, and threes. One's four, fives, and sixes. And you need to get four of.
And it's really
pretty
hard.
Yeah.
But it's completely possible within 2 to 3 turns.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I mean, you could at least get one of them within 2 to 3 turns. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's very easy to get, because you're getting combos to be able to turn ones into sixes, be able to turn, give plus ones on your die rolls, all different things. Turns fives into twos, like different things here or there. So as you're playing, it gets so easy. But that's why I liked jump so much, was because it was an easy way to do it, and I didn't screw it up as much as I screwed up now. So I mean, within all that,
take the
it was
success as well you can.
Exactly.
At least when we played it, we didn't do the seat change damage when it came up, because then it would have been like, oh look, I can jump. Oh shit, now I'm doing engineering. Oh crap, I'm doing damage. I have no idea what the hell.
And
I'm
even
doing.
Being a beginning player, that was my other thing about it. This game was being a beginning player. Each station is so intricate. Learning it again for another station if you switch seats.
Yeah,
it's just
and they all have
much.
Different strategies, but I believe Chris wants to elaborate on probably the most important seat of them all.
Yeah, so I got damage control with repair, and then I also was doing the weapons. Weapons is pretty cool. That's basically the Tetris game. I flip over a card and it has a design on it. I have to match little pieces that look like Tetris pieces to that design. If I do that, I get to fire a weapon. Firing a weapon is you play a shuffleboard. Shuffleboard has no locks, locks, and then super locks. If you have a lock, you do more damage. If you have a super lock, you definitely do more damage. And then it has a range from 1 to 6. You have to flick a die. Or, I guess really not a die. What would you really call that?
A disc?
A disc, yeah. I don't know why I couldn't think of that word.
What is that thing, made of wood?
Yeah, it's made of wood.
Little red wooden disc.
Yes, not a die. But so you flick it. It's probably a, 14-inch board, maybe?
14, yeah.
And,
it's a good judge of measurement you got there.
Yeah, yeah. That's because I play War Machine, no big deal.
Yeah, and lose. But by technicality. You won.
I actually won, but whatever. But that's pretty fun. Not too crazy, pretty easy. It gets crazy if the captain wants to be pretty much be a giant D-bag and give me 3 points of energy. Then I would get 3 puzzles, and I only have probably about 25 Tetris pieces to try to get 3 puzzles done within 30 seconds. I couldn't even get 2 puzzles done in 30 seconds.
Yeah, I find it really hard to believe that someone could physically accomplish 3.
Clint did.
Clint can do it, but Clint's a master at anything he puts his fucking hands on.
Yeah. So the next big thing is really damage control and repair. Damage control is when pretty much Helm messes up and Shield mess up together.
Yeah.
So what will happen is, if there's not enough damage to be taken from the shields, I get to do damage. In which, depending on which location it is, I draw a damage card. And it'll either be straight up damage, no effect, continuous. And what they will be is like, hey, all right, damage to weapons. Weapons lose 1 strength for the entire round, and you also absorb 1 damage, which is really devastating. And then the cards just continuously stack like that. What happens is when you get a no effect card, it goes out of the deck completely and it's gone from the game. So not only do you have less cards to take damage now, because I think there's probably about 9 cards in each sector that you can take damage in,
If you take damage in there again and they're still not shields, if you exhaust all those cards, you get a core breach, which core breaches is pretty much how you lose the game. A core breach is, I think Ethan talked about it a little bit earlier, you basically would pass out a number of cards set on the core breach tracker. And within your action phase, you have 30 seconds to do your job and repair the core breach. If one of you don't repair your core breach, ship's blown up. End of the game. Sorry,
epic
brothers.
Fail. Epic fail.
And then it goes from like 3 cards to 4 cards, I think, to 5 cards, to 7 cards, to 8 cards, to 11 cards.
Ending at 14.
So.
Which if you can successfully accomplish 14 core breach cards in the matter of 30 seconds while accomplishing your task, you need to come over and help us beat this damn game.
Yeah. And then repair is basically the opportunity to repair your ship. You can do that with no energy, but you have to draw a card. It's either going to be straight-up damage, straight-up repair, or half and half, and you have to repair. And it's either going to be a better chance for you to actually repair or a better chance for you to take another damage, and you roll a dice.
50-50.
So you get a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6, and the card tells you what will happen on that dice roll. What you use the energy for is you can either negate one of those. I know that's the only thing you can do with energy on repair is negate. And basically, if you take all repairs and they're all successful, you can get rid of the continuous cards, which I think how the rules read is they don't go back in the deck. They're just gone for the rest of the game. But it doesn't really necessarily say that in the rules, so I'm not 100% sure, because it's backwards on two pieces of paper, depending on which page you're reading in the rule book. So that's where we messed up on, because I'm not sure. Because you definitely get rid of the successful ones, and it's like, well, then you reshuffle. But for continuous effects, they're gone for the remainder of the game if you remove them. So I'd assume that you take them out, which means you would have less damage to take on that side of the ship. So all in all, everything is really just intertwined to each other, and it's devastating if you mess up. But a great,
it's a very,
great game.
It's a very cooperative game.
Oh, yes. Like Ghost Stories.
Ghost Stories. I still haven't played that game yet.
I'm going to mention that game in every podcast until I play it.
Every single one. All right. After that coverage of Space Cadets, we are going to continue into describing it on our rating scale.
Which is a 6.5.
Which is an epic fail because it's a 7.5 scale.
I thought it was 6.5.
No, it's a 7.5.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure it's a 7.5. Maybe it is a 6.5.
I don't remember.
Son of a bitch. This is what happens when we don't do it on a 10 scale.
Where's Ryan?
So, for John and Andrew who join us, we rate on a 7.5 scale. So far, I think the highest thing we've... Maybe it is a 6.5 scale. Because
I think
we've
given a 6.
No, I think the highest we've given is a 5.5.
Okay.
All right. So, we'll do it on a 6.5 scale, and from here on out, if we've been doing it on a 7.5, fuck that, we're on a 6.5 scale. So, we will begin with John with his rating and reason on a 6.5 scale.
A 6.5 scale. Well, I mean, for the first time being here, with Zombicide, which is my all-time favorite game of all time, only being would be a 6 on this. It hasn't peaked over that 0.5 a little bit just yet.
You always got to peak that point.
Exactly. You got to peak that. And with the new
John
stuff that's coming out.
John also only played 2 games.
I played more than 2.
He's played more than enough games.
I played at least 4 of them.
All right, 4 games.
Okay,
four games.
Oh my God. Anyways, I have to give this about, I'd say, a 3.
Really?
I'm going to give it pretty low. I'm going to give it pretty low because the learning curve is really high.
Might I add, the box states that it's a game for ages 8 and up, which is a load of bullshit.
Wait.
Like, Stronghold, you gotta be fucking kidding me.
Yeah, that's
like,
that's.
And even that, board game suggested it as a 12 and up game.
Those
and
are like,
it can be 12 and up
children.
If somebody
I
in
work
their
20s
is sitting there telling them how to play
it's
it.
It's obviously 8 plus because their parent is explaining it. If you clearly look at the picture.
The parent, isn't explaining it to him. The parent is playing for him.
Probably.
Or the parent,
here, little Timmy, let me just do it.
But anyway, a 3. So continue with the why.
Okay, so first of all, it's a very complicated game. Learning curve is really high. And with the learning curve being so high, you're going to need to play this game multiple times. I'd say you need to play it almost 3 to 4 times to be able to get each station.
Yeah.
And be able to be proficient at each station.
I mean, even us in our 20s, we're still struggling just by getting through the instruction manual.
With that being said, it being almost a 2-hour game is just, it's just too much, man. Like, with the first time, we zoomed right into the explanation. We zoomed right into the game. And it even still took us almost, what? good almost 2 hours.
It was probably less than 2 hours. It was probably near 2 hours.
You see, with that right there, I'm not as eager to pick it up again because I'm like, man, when am I going to be able to blow 2 hours and try and lose at a game? So, I mean, that's why it's a 3 in my book. As far as the rest of the game, dude, it was fun as all get out. The aspect and the core concept of the game was really fun. And if there's a way we could get a better rule book, that'd bring it up another point.
Well, I don't know. It also says video rules explanations at strongholdgames.com.
They're not that effective.
Oh, okay.
They're not.
Never mind.
I watched them. They're not that effective.
If we, and that was the other thing. If we can get video rules, that's even better. But obviously there is. I haven't checked that out yet. But a better rule book, A. And then the second way is, my other reason why it's lower is, the game almost looks cheap. Like, the game itself, like, for instance, there's no plastic miniature, which, if you're paying about $50, it's understandable, but at $50.
At $50, Adventurer still gives you a bunch of 3D models.
Exactly.
You know?
And, I mean, like, I'd almost want, and this cardboard's kind of like flimsy cardstock cardboard, a thicker board, like, for instance, like you see from Seven Wonders, that kind of cardstock would be amazing.
That would be awesome.
For this. And then better dice. I know you guys like the wooden dice, but even wooden dice with the little numbers ground in, where it's an indent instead of just the paint over it, that'd be better.
That is true. They weren't indented.
They were just painted
dots or whatever the hell they're called.
So I mean, like, if you rub the dice together long enough, that's gonna rub off, and you're like, well, what the hell is this number?
Yeah.
So,
blanks are twos. Just heads up. Blanks are twos.
Yeah.
On that dice, actually, blanks are fives.
So with all things considered, the game concept blew me away. A game where you're playing games of my childhood into the game, greatest concept of all time. But being able to play like Yahtzee, Tetris, all these different sweet games, pipes, that was cool. That was awesome. Now if they could clean it up, make it easier to play, make it look nicer, I would give it, let's say, all things considered, they had a better board, the game looked nicer, and the rule book was rewritten, I'd probably give it a 4 or 5.
Always be the pessimist.
I would.
All right. Andrew, how'd you feel about it?
Well, I'm going to go up a little bit higher than John on this one. I'm going to give it a 4.5 out of it. I do agree with him on some of the rules, on some of the points he made. I feel that, you know, it is a very difficult game, high learning curve right off the bat. It does feel a little disconjointed in terms of the rules. You know, I have my fiance is a English major. She would have a fit with this rule book. But I personally like games that challenge me. And that I will, you know, that it frustrates me to the point of no end. Because when you do eventually win, you know, it might be 20, 30, 40 games down the road. But when you do win, you're like, oh my God, that was the most amazing thing ever. And you will, it's kind of a story that you will talk about with people.
Well, like, and also the second that, the fact that, you know, the fact that we constantly keep losing keeps us coming back and playing the game over and over because we want to beat the damn thing.
And we're masochistic in that sense. We want to play it. And I love those kinds of games. That's why I love in the video games. I love those in board games. So I love the difficulty at that level. I feel that this game, because the cheapness that he pointed out, I don't think is so much cheap as in I think it's kind of a middle ground. Where people who are coming from the Settlers of Catan area and the intro board games, and then you've got the serious hardcore games on the other side, it's kind of a meeting place where it is difficult and expansive enough for those who are really hardcore gamers to take up and enjoy, but it also has a quirkiness and a feel that would allow just the general populace to come in and take it. So it's kind of like a meeting place, like a little joiner to let everyone play.
16.
Now, I have to reserve this judgment in the fact that I would have to play it a few more times to figure out, you know, how the nuance to say, you know, this is all with a grain of salt because I've only to play one game. But I would have to say that at this venture, I give it about a 4.5 out of 6.5. I love the game. I would play it again. And, yeah.
Pretty creepy, Chris. How are you feeling in your corner?
All right, I feel pretty good in my corner. First off, since John said the game is cheap and just looks really cheesy,
I just want to know, I want everyone to know that look up Space Cadets and look at how awesome the box picture is, because the driver is holding a soda. That's how easy this game should be, that the driver has a soda, and everyone on the box looks really cool.
I couldn't have held the soda and done the stuff I had to do as the helm.
But, honestly, I want to give this game, like, a 5.75.
Ooh.
Just for the fact that I love games that bring something unique and something different that I haven't really seen, and this game brings awesome components that aren't in a game, so it's got a unique factor to it, and I love that. The game is really, really close to Space Alert, which is a spacey game, and, co-op games that just kick the shit out of you are so much fun. Because when you do lose, it's like, oh, you know, we lost, whatever. But when you win, you're just like, damn it, Ethan, remember that time we played this? And, like, it was, like, round seven, and the Nemesis ship was right next to us, but somehow, you know, we jumped it, used the jump, and we got away, and we won, we got all the crystals, whatever you did. And when, you're going to remember that. And every time you play and lose, be like, you know, there was this one time we did actually win. And it was sweet.
It's fucking awesome. It's like one of those stories where you're like, you know, you're not going to believe this, what happened.
Yeah, and the game, honestly, having so many different things going on at once, and they're all being really unique and something that everyone can remember, is really cool. Maybe the game isn't so well made, but that's okay. I'm not picky. I want theme in a game. I want uniqueness. I want cool components. And I just want something that's fun and entertaining for everyone. And I think this game brings all of that to it. Is it a little hard with less than six people? Yeah. Is it playable with less than six people? Yeah. Is it still fun and you still feel like you're in a spaceship and controlling everything that's going on? Yeah, you do. So the game has just loads and loads and loads of space theme. So I love it.
Well, I almost feel like these two should be managing the podcast since they gave lower reviews than we are. But I actually, I'm going to give the game a 5.5. Which, you know, ironically, I think every single game we reviewed, I've given a 5.5 right now, which is probably terrible on my part. The theme is fucking awesome. I'm not a big fan of space games, but man, this was one space game that I'm happy that I spur bought. Awesome $50 spent. I really enjoy the fact that it's a cooperative game, but really, like, it has so many elements that are not cooperative of each person playing their own type of games inside of it. And I also enjoy that fact because, you know, it doesn't... Some cooperative games where everybody's doing the same thing, you kind of get to this point where, like, one player does it better than the other players, so the other players kind of just, like, check out, not really do anything, and just rely on that one player to do this task the entire time. You know, and everybody's doing different tasks, there's a possibility of everybody getting switched around, and, you know, it's a game where everybody's on their feet, they're on a timer, and they're being proactive inside of the game. So the theme's totally awesome. I will say, the instruction manual, man, that's... I bought it and I've been relying on Chris pretty much to tell me what the instruction manual means.
Yeah, Stronghold Games is a...
You have a degree. You can tell me how this thing works.
You need to look up some fantasy books and read those.
I will say if the instruction manual was improved, this game would probably reach more of a 6 for me. It's fun. It's awesome. It's great for new gamers if someone's teaching you how to play it. It's terrible for new gamers if you're diving right into it. You know, and I agree with you, Andrew. It was a good in-between game. You know, it's while the instruction manual is difficult, yes, we've said that a million times, it's great for new players to try and get into it as a cooperative game that's a little bit, you know, higher pace than your standard cooperative games, and it's a little bit, you know, it's a nice step in between playing something like Catan and then trying to play something like Quest for Middle Earth or Middle Earth Quest or whatever the hell it was called, where it's a giant cooperative game that takes tons of time. You know, it's a mid-range, about an hour and a half. You know, it's a little bit longer for new gamers, but your standard Catan game probably goes about 45 minutes to an hour, you know, or longer if you're introducing thieves, etc. So, you know, at 5.5, I think that's a pretty sturdy rating for it. It's awesome. It's loads of fun, and I definitely recommend people go out and pick it up. It's a fun game for groups of people, even as minimal as three. You'll still have a total blast playing it.
I mean, for the price, it being as the price it is, I would say pick it up, try it out, do what you got to do with it. And it's, I mean, your local game shop, I don't know what they run with stuff like that, but that's a great way to go find a local game shop. You're not going to find it in a retail store. It's a great way to go find your local game shop. Go find your local, we have Clint. Go find your local Clint and sit down, talk to him, and, you know, really get it, delve into this world of board games. That's far beyond Monopoly, Risk,
and everything like that. If you're interested in playing the game and you don't want to drop the $50, just drive to Cincinnati. We'll play it with you.
Done.
We've been more than happy to play this game on multiple occasions. You know, we're always here on Wednesdays, usually every single Sunday, and more than enough times we don't have lives and we're here every other day anyway.
Finding your local Clint, that sounds like a nice catchphrase.
Yeah, hopefully, and, hopefully that doesn't get muffled in the microphone, because if it's finding your local Clint, who knows?
And disclaimer, John and Andrew, I don't think has played board games as long as Ethan and I.
No, not at all. So not at all.
Obviously with the reviews, I think we always do give stuff higher, because where they haven't played extensive games.
I've played extremely terrible games.
I've played games that take 7 hours. It's called Rune Wars, and it's one of the best games ever made, but it does take 7 hours. So
see, that's just me. Like that right there, me was tight.
Yes, which is apparently it doesn't have a time frame. It goes on forever.
Yeah.
But with that, that's our review for Space Cadets. Hopefully, if we intrigued you, you want to go look it up. Maybe buy it, play it, try it, whatever you need to do.
Yeah, come hang out and play it with us.
I think we're going to move on to some miniature talkings.
Yep, so hang brief for a moment. Listen to our awesome music, which is supplied to us by Travel, you know, local Cincinnati poet, musician from Squirt Gun, who actually plays with Travel now. He's a bitchin' dude. So we'll be back here in less than 30 seconds to talk about wargaming. Thanks, guys. Everybody, welcome back to Clean Cut Casual. We are now going to discuss miniature wargaming games and the attraction to playing them. So far, we got a mix of different miniature games among the four of us. Andrew had to leave for personal reasons, and now we have Clint joining in on us,
which is the shop owner, Eastside Games and Cards.
Yeah, he's a cool dude, you know. So we have we got covered. Warhammer, we've got Lord of the Rings miniatures, we've got Mercs, we've got War Machine, which is the shit, of course.
Clint's probably favorite's what, Flames of War still?
Maybe. Yeah, we got Clint on Flames of War. Shit, we got more than enough stuff to talk about. So, I guess we'll start by circling around the table on talking about why people got into playing miniature games. I'm sure everybody's, you know, similar and a little bit different. So, I guess we'll start with me. The reason why I got into playing miniature games was A, because everybody at the shop was playing miniature games, you know, so it was all the cool kids. So everybody was kind of leaving, you know, playing Magic in order to play miniatures. That plus, I'm an artist by trade, so obviously I love fucking painting the damn things, you know. Even though paint for miniatures can get a little expensive if you want it to look nice, and to be the difference in between a good painter and a really good painter, meaning the difference in between myself and Clint, is the fact that some people know how to use things like epoxy and other crazy shit. Wow, or whatever the fuck it's called. Epoxy? Yeah.
Resin.
There we go. Resin, you know, all those pot smokers. Some people know all those pot smokers who are listening to this, you know.
Yeah. Who knows what terms and other words mean? Yeah. Who uses these words?
You know, like, I enjoy painting them. The assembly can be a little irritating because you kind of sit there for a while until Sean shows up and sprays it with the accelerator and then you get it stuck to your hand. But aside from that, like, painting, totally fucking awesome. How about you, Chris?
What really drew me to it, I think, was I was broke and poor at the time, and I just kept coming into Clint's shop, and he kept playing Flames of War, and it's World War II, I think.
Yeah,
right?
Historical.
And the tanks on it looked sweet. Little miniatures looked way too small for me to ever be able to paint, but the mechanics of the game looked pretty sweet, and that's what intrigued me into the games of miniatures.
I didn't even know you played Flames of War.
I do not own a Flames of War unit. What happened was I played the game probably 5 or 6 times with Clint on Sundays, and then I got a job, and then I met Ryan. Oh. And then Ryan was like, I got an army in Warhammer, so I dropped probably $1,000 in Warhammer, and I've played it once.
Best expenditure of money. Because you were broke, you got into playing Warhammer, the most expensive one out there. Aside from heavy gear. Heavy gear's a fucking joke, the cost of how much it costs to play. Of course, it's like Clint's shit right now. How about you, Clint? Ask the geezer at the table.
How you got into it?
How you got into playing miniature games?
Playing toy soldiers when you were a little kid.
Oh, man.
What was that, back in the 60s for you?
Yeah, we used rocks to
paper dolls, baby.
And no, but there was an old company called Airfix that used to make little scale World War II minis and tanks and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I guess my whole family was into history, and so we played.
Yeah, well, your dad was into gaming, too, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, we all used to make up our own games and rules and stuff like that.
no, this soldier kills this soldier. Yeah. He's wearing red.
Well, we made up rules for, like, Ralparth is a local game manufacturer, or toy manufacturer, made
right.
Lead Minis, and so I made up rules for, like, they had a lot of fantasy. Yeah. Made up rules.
Well, they did. They Ralparth specialized in doing, like, dragons and stuff. They were a lot of, like, D&D style games.
They did have some historical stuff, but a lot of it was fantasy. Skeletons and elves and dwarves and stuff like that.
Oh, my.
Yeah. But as a side note onto that, though, the guy who actually used to own Ralparth is practically my next-door neighbor. So hopefully at some point in the future of this podcast we'll interview him, but I heard he's a little... Well, he's a shy character. Well, he used to do dragon sculpts and stuff.
Yeah, there was like five or six owners, partners of that place.
Right, yeah.
But, yeah, the big interest, I guess, in the miniatures is there's something out there for everybody. If you like science fiction, fantasy, history, and all the time periods.
Oh, yeah.
There's always somebody makes a
And it's an ever-developing game, too. You know, it's one of those things where it's like you buy a board game, everything comes in the box, you wait a year until they come out with an expansion, and the expansion's subpar, et cetera, changes things that you like and dislike. But, like, you know, with miniature games, you can constantly, like, make the army bigger, you can strip them and repaint them to a different color if you want to, so there's always an avenue for you to keep digging deeper into playing miniature games that, you know, most people, you build a bigger army, there's other people to play it with, you know, and like that plus changing of terrain on tables when playing in games makes different experiences or different objectives you're playing. So it's an ever-changing game where it's like the rules are set, but the side factors that affect the game constantly keep it intriguing. How about you, John?
Actually, it's interesting. I don't think I've ever told you this, but the reason I got into miniatures was actually because of you, Ethan.
Woo! Make a casual win.
No, I'm not even joking. I was up here at Clint's shop some random day, and I was sitting here about ready to play some Magic, trying to get someone to play Standard. Couldn't freaking get anybody to play, so I sat and talked to Ethan for a little bit. And Ethan's painting his old Protectorate army, and
was
I thought
painting,
it...
Was that painting Protectorate?
You were painting Protectorate. I remember why, anymore. Because it was an awesome color of orange. And I'm not, and this is the weirdest thing in the world. I thought it looked so awesome. The orange with the white Protectorate and like these shielded big dudes with the rounded bases. And just all of it looked so just awesome. I was like, dude, I kind of want to play a miniatures game. So what did I do? I decided to get into Lord of the Rings. My least favorite miniatures game of all time right now. It's a good game for the people that like it. I just didn't like it. I didn't like the game style.
You got into it for the Lord of the Rings theme.
Exactly.
Because you like Lord of the Rings, exactly. You know? Like,
I didn't see anybody playing War Machine.
Right.
So, I mean, like, I ended up one day getting into War Machine eventually, which is the one I really like, because Clint had a two-player battle box up here. So I ended up just buying cash and just buying that battle box right off the bat. And it ended up going into the aspect of... I wanted to have a game I could play with some friends, and I wanted to have a two-player battle box so that I could play with some friends and be able to get my friends as well into miniatures to be able to branch into something besides Magic. Because unfortunately, Magic is a fun game, but you're so, so limited with it. You're very, very limited with it because with Standard, you're not going to want to play anybody who's not playing Standard because you spent the money, you spent... an ungodly amount of money in order to make Standard and be able to build that deck. But with miniatures, you're able to just build it and it doesn't matter.
Well, that, and the second off that, being you and I both being kind of like more the Magic players that came into playing tabletop war games, mm-hmm. like, you know, there's some element of originality in Magic, but especially now that like Standard, you know, the current format of the whatever past year or 2 years of cards has kind of become so like, it's no longer focused around being creative and originality. Like, everybody does their net decking, they build the best deck, and they just go into tournaments with that. You know, there's no sense of originality to it. And, like, I think, for me, like, getting into a war game, you can actually bring a little bit of your own flavor and your likes into a game. Like, if you want to get really crazy, you can buy other parts, and you can change the parts of what your miniatures look like, depending on what game you're playing, obviously, that has rules and tournaments that you're not allowed to do that. But, you know, it gave me a creative outlet to be able to play these games and have a sense of me in it rather than being like, oh, I'm playing X person who's playing Dark Confidant, Tarmogoyf, Jace the Mind Sculptor decks, which are pretty much the standard legacy tier one bullshit that's on the internet everywhere.
Do you know, honestly, the other aspect of miniatures, which what got me to miniatures too, was EDH.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the format of Magic where that creativity comes back into the game. Whereas you brought up one of the greatest ideas with that was building a lower costing deck and then going into it. And this brought that creativity aspect that you're talking about with miniatures back into Magic. Whereas I have a limit to it. Whereas in these games, here's the issue with miniatures that I've found so far is you step into it with your first time without any knowledge. Like, I stepped into Lord of the Rings without any knowledge of miniatures.
Yeah, gameplay. A very book-heavy war game.
Exactly. Dude. And that was exactly what I didn't want. I didn't want a book-heavy war game that was going to be a very expensive game to get into.
Yeah, well, that's why we got into playing War Machine.
Exactly.
It was like War Machine. It was like, yeah, there was books with it that explained it, but, like, in the long run, you have a fucking card in front of you that says, exactly, like, this is what this motherfucker does.
Exactly, and this is how you roll, this is how you assign damage. And also, the reason why War Machine's better than, in my opinion, is one of the better games, is because there actually is, you can learn it from video representation.
Right.
Okay, so, for instance, I tried learning Lord of the Rings and Warhammer from a video representation.
God.
It took so long.
Right.
There are so many different facets to it that it was too hard to follow. War Machine was just dot, dot, dot.
Right. Well, and War Machine 2, while, yes, the game has gone through transitions and changes, you know, it was a game that they came out with it, they had it ironed right, and they didn't mess around with it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like the biggest pet peeve I hear a lot of the Warhammer people complain about is, like, they constantly change the rules and what each faction or family or whatever they're called do, and it constantly turns into like a rules A get trumped by rules B, which get trumped by rule C, and it turns into this, like, even if you're not playing the army, you still got to pay attention to, like, what the changes in the rules that affect the game.
Which is sad, because out of everything, Warhammer 40K is by far some of my favorite models.
Right.
Oh, so they have some of the awesome coolest models of all time, because Games Workshop really put their time into saying, okay, I want to do this. And they're some of the most versatile models of any format of game I've played before.
Right.
So, I mean, like, the game itself of Warhammer 40K is, in my opinion, is cool just because of, A, the size of armies, and then, B, the actual sculpt of the model.
Yeah.
But where it falls short, in my opinion, is the rulebook.
Mm-hmm.
And the number of dice you're playing with.
Yeah. Well, how I sum it up is, like, Warhammer, probably the best war game that's ever made. But I sum it up as being a you-had-to-be-there type of game. Meaning, like, you had to have started playing a long time ago, and you had to have kept playing to keep up on what's going on. So, like, it's a game that's not easily set up for new players to join in and play to. So, I mean, if you're someone who wants to get into wargaming, that's probably the last game I'd say sign up and play at first. I'm not saying don't play it. It's an awesome game, and it has beautiful sculpts. But, like, it's definitely not something you want to jump into, because you're going to spend a lot of money. It's not cheap. And you're going to get extremely frustrated right off the bat, because everybody's going to be citing rules from pages of books that you didn't even know existed.
Exactly.
You know?
Because reading the rule book is just huge. Mm-hmm. And it's so filled with just this fluff that everyone says that it's reading from front cover to cover is nearly impossible.
Right.
Because by the time you get halfway through it, you're just ready to be done with it. But bringing it back to the other aspect of Lord of the Rings, when I brought Lord of the Rings, the reason why I didn't like Lord of the Rings is everything is trade.
Right.
And I like that free roam movement of the of it. Now, what I've heard, though, is the new Hobbit, if I'm correct, it actually is untrade. Yes. Where you actually move everything individually.
Individual, like a skirmish game.
And within that, I'm almost interested in getting back into it.
Because we originally started you with War of the Ring,
mm-hmm.
which is a large-scale armies.
Mm-hmm.
Right. How'd that turn out, by the way? I guess they answer it before I ask questions. So the shop was running a War of the Ring tournament that lasted how many weeks?
A league? Yeah, we're still playing.
Really? You guys are still playing?
Yeah.
So they're pretty much running a league with a giant map that they pretty much just constantly move across the world and fight against other armies, claiming territory, you know, which is another awesome element about war games. It's like, You can bring...
It's a campaign ongoing. Yeah.
You can bring that exterior campaign element where you can constantly, rather than setting up a league like you play player A, then player B, then player C, you can actually be like, this is where you are on the map. You are marching here, attack this person. You know, and like most war games, you can do that pretty much probably with any war game.
Yeah.
Like, especially for heavy gear now. Like, you could probably play the shit out of heavy gear doing that. Even Mercs, you could probably do that.
Yeah. No, Mercs has a campaign. Yeah. Mercs is pretty
Flames
sweet.
Of War, you could almost do the entire World War II.
They have tons of books for campaigns.
Well, Flames of War, and then what is it? 7 Years War? 5 Years War?
7 Years
War. Seven Years War. That's like, that pretty much what is that game is.
See, and for history buffs, like, this brings a whole new aspect of history to it, because this almost lets you be in the battle where you're worried about the troops, you're worried about the positioning, you're worried about the luck of the battle, the heat of the battle, where it brings that whole new aspect of, you know, I could talk about Gettysburg, but let me jump into Gettysburg.
Yeah. Like, I don't know all the rules for 7 Years War, but I also feel like those type of games too, like ones that are more like Civil War based or very military based, like there's that extra element when you're playing where you could be like, oh, like I suffered a large loss, I can back out of the fight. You know, and when in campaign terms, you know, you could be like, I don't want my army being decimated in the first match, like that the size of your army changes depending on each game that you play, if you are on the offensive, defensive, etc.
I mean, within that size of your army changes and stuff, that's kind of a cool aspect when you're looking at campaigns. Is because, you know, like, for instance, let's say we're doing this huge map where you have the whole map of the United States and you're marching across the United States with your army and you get halfway through and you're like, oh, crap, I might die if I continue. And you back out for a little bit, let everyone skirmish around each other. And then you have a chance to rebuild, get yourself in there, wait for the other armies to kind of whittle down a little bit, then step back in and go. Yeah. It brings this whole new...
It's a strategy outside of the game.
Exactly. It's a strategy outside of the game of when do I attack, when do I not? Should I sit out for a Saturday and maybe come back next Saturday and bust some heads? Yeah. Like, what do I do here or there? And it's an interesting way of bringing life into your game.
Right.
Instead of making game into life, it's bringing life into your game. And I almost say it's an inexpensive way of doing it as well. Coming from a Magic player, when I'm seeing these guys with 1,000-piece armies, they say, okay, I spent a lot of money on it, but that's all they spend.
Right.
That's it. That's done.
You spend it, you cap it, that's your army. You know, you make tweaks, whatever, but your money is up front to build it.
I've been in Magic now for a little under a year. Just really a little under a year. That's it. And I've already spent over $5,000 into Magic.
Yeah, but you bought a lot of Magic.
I jumped heavy into Magic. I've jumped heavy into Magic.
Yeah, head first.
Yeah, I mean, I within the first year, I had almost all the dual lands. So, I mean, like, and now I'm slowing down. So, like, and now slowing down out of Magic, I'm looking for, okay, what can I occupy my time with?
And occupy your wallet with.
Exactly.
That's how I feel about it. It's the greatest feeling in the world. Spend my money?
It's the greatest feeling in the world looking down and seeing green in your wallet. And that's miniatures.
What I like about miniatures, and what I think you guys might have like the aspect wrong, is like Warhammer and 40K is like a really big tactical game. It's large armies. Why they're in trays is because that's actually how you're marching and rotating takes energy.
It's fantasy.
Fans. Sorry, and you know, obviously in real life, if you're marching and turning, that takes energy, that takes action, so it should take part of your turn. And I think the game's more strategic than what War Machine is. I mean, they're both tactical, but I think for larger armies, you are deciding a lot more things. I think the trade depth matters in fantasy.
Yes.
So like, not only because of your rolls, like, yeah, you may kill a few, but because you're deeper in, you have more men, so they're still going to lose troops, because obviously you're overwhelming them. So even if you aren't going to hit them hard, if you're deep enough within your tray, you're still going to wreak havoc on their units, especially when you're just going balls to the walls on them. I think Rick said it best, War Machine is broken, it's meant to be broken, it's meant to be dirty and quick, and you're supposed to be able to kill shit. Mm-hmm. And with the other bigger games, it's really, you're thinking about it. Every move is crucial. How you position your dudes matters.
How you turn them.
Everything in that game is just really, really based on every move you make, where it is a little bit too on War Machine, but that game is a little more loose because you know it's meant to be, let's get in your grill, let's swing some shit, let's roll some dice and do some damage.
So we talked a decent amount about, you know, Warhammer's different tabletop games. We also, or wargaming games, excuse me. We also talked about, you know, War Machine, Lord of the Rings, but more recently, a group of players, including Chris and Clint here with us right now, have gotten into playing the game Mercs, along with a couple other miniature games. I don't want to say new, because they're old miniature games that are more coming arise. If you guys want to go ahead and discuss that experience of more playing, like, I don't want to say independent, but, like, you know, younger
war games. I think Mercs came out at the end of 2010, maybe. And then 2011, they decided to develop starter boxes. It's a skirmish game. You only field five troops. And the starter box, you get six. It's $65.
They're very, very cheap.
So that's a super, super cheap miniatures game. If you want to learn how a miniatures game works and you don't want to spend a lot of money, Mercs is definitely where it's at. The rule book is $35. It's a hardbound rule book. It's probably the cheapest rule book I've seen that's hardbound.
Yeah.
Or hardcover.
Full color.
And, They have huge diagrams in it of how everything works, and the game's not meant to be to discuss like a rule and look into it and be like, well, I really don't think you can do it. The game is kind of like how War Machine is. It's meant to be played, just do it and have fun with it, not really question what the rules, and then be like, well, that's not how that works because my army does this. And what's cool about that game is there's no tape measure. How you move is the card, and you get like 3 points, I think, is what's... No, I guess 2 points is typical for everyone else except for me.
Yeah, average movements. One card length, which is probably a typical playing card length. So yeah. It's probably like...
3.5.
Three to four inches.
4 inches for a guy.
Yeah, and it's meant to be where it's played on a 4x...
2x3.
2x3, that's right. So it's a small box.
Small table.
And you are not supposed to be able to see someone in the first turn, and how heavy guns and assault rifles and snipers, if you can see them, you can shoot them. Handguns, I think, has a range of one card, and then melee is within one
inch.
Base.
Yeah, within 1 inch, which is a base width, yeah.
And what the guys that made Mercs tried to do in that game is not make it so much about, I have this army and they're overpowered, so I'm going to win. They tried making the game more about how you use your tactics and how you approach your attacks or ambushes for the game instead of making, you know, just one ridiculously good faction. The factions are supposed to be pretty even. I think with what we've played, we've seen a few problems in some of them. I'm sure the FAQs probably sum up how we're doing that wrong. But Mr. Ryan Hicks, who isn't with us tonight, actually, I think, found the game. And we showed it off to, like, one. And pretty much everyone that plays miniature games here has bought a faction, two Mercs. I think everyone's honestly really enjoyed the game.
Yeah, it's quick.
It's an inexpensive skirmish game, which is awesome.
In your face. I mean, there's certain guys in your army that'll be hand-to-hand melee combat. Other guys be your long range. And there are objectives as well. We've just been playing mainly kill.
Yeah. We should be playing with blood points so I can win every damn time. But whatever, that's fine. And there's a campaign to the game. The guy's goals for Mercs is every year now they want to come out with one new character. Characters cost $10.
Yeah.
So if you put $65 into it, the max characters they're going to have is 10. So you'd be spending an extra $40 to have the whole army. And they're just going to do one a year. And right now they're talking about redoing the rule book because they've added... Two new factions, I think?
Four.
Yeah. There's four new factions.
Eight factions right now.
And they finally had starter boxes. And the guys that made the game are really, you know, going to what everyone's saying. There's tournaments for it. There was a tournament for it last year at Gen Con. There probably was at Origins and who else knows where. But it's an amazing little skirmish game. It's loads of fun. It's quick and easy. And you really got to figure out how your army works to benefit you, and what tactics you really need to be applying with your army, which is super awesome. And for $65, I mean, if you're ever wondering about a miniatures game, or like, hey, that tabletop game looks cool, this is something you should definitely buy for $65. Because you can either love it or hate it, but either way, you only invested $65, where most miniature games, you're investing a lot more.
Hundreds, yeah.
And now that we talked about the most inexpensive... I'm going to ask Clint to elaborate on Heavy Gear, which is probably one of the more pricier games that I've heard.
It's not as bad as some, I would say. The starter boxes are, what, $115? Give you about 10 guys.
Yeah.
For the average faction. It's a mech, kind of like a almost BattleTech, or if you played Mech Warrior, it's piloted robots in most cases. So there's a cockpit area. Guys are kind of humanoid looking, and they robotic. Some of them probably have jump packs. I've sold a few. We've got a few guys with factions, and we haven't played yet because guys are still assembling their models.
Yeah, those
because
pieces
you can equip each model differently, and it comes with tons of bits, so you can put like a long range, short range, mid range rocket pods, different types of auto cannon.
So that's similar to like 40K, where it's like depending on what weapons you actually attach to them, it changes the stats and what
right.
they do.
Yeah, you know, 40K is, well, the Heavy Gear is a smaller scale, so it's like a 15 millimeter scale. Some of the mechs are pretty large, and then the 40K is like a 28 millimeter scale, so like typical model is probably an inch and a quarter tall, and that's like a human,
mm-hmm.
and it's about the same size as one of the mechs in the Heavy Gear. So the models are larger in 40K and can be very large. But 40K, there's Games Workshop, they've been out for probably, I think, 25 years and have evolved a lot. They were all metal. They went to trying to go all plastic to keep the cost down, but the cost is expensive for a model or for a troop, but it is the most popular game in the United States. It might not be in the world, but it is in the United States most popular miniature game.
They've got a really big following in Europe, I know.
Well,
that.
it's an English company, and yeah, they supply all of Europe and who knows about Asia and the rest of the world, but
right. Asia's probably busy playing like Super Dungeon Explorer.
Something. But,
from Cool Mini or not.
But yeah, 40K, if you want to play a game where you can go to any town in the United States and play a miniature game, like if you travel a lot or are in college or something and you're bouncing all over the country, you could go into any game store in the country and play 40K
right.
with your army. If you take in some of these smaller companies, smaller games, systems, chances are not as popular, not as big a crowd. But
unless you live in Seattle. If you live in Seattle and you play War Machine, you will find everybody there who plays it.
War Machine has been out for 15 years, and they have redone the rules just one time, and that was about 2 years ago. So.
Right.
Because it was over the top broken in first edition, and they finally had to control it and kind of take away a little bit of the craziness, and it's grown again with the craziness. So,
game sweet.
I guess to stick on time, I have one more small topic to discuss is the growing popularity of wargaming, you know, miniature based games. How do you feel that has been effective on the current board game market due to the fact that, especially with Kickstarter becoming so popular now, a large quantity of games that are being made are usually made containing miniatures, usually made by Cool Mini or not, because they make awesome miniatures. But, you know, it's been a growing trend of people using miniatures in their game designs. How do you guys feel about that?
Well, I think it feels, if you buy a board game, and it does come with some really nice miniatures, even, you know, the Euro games with the little wooden blocks or pegs or whatever, those, everybody would rather play with a miniature or a cube than playing with just a cardboard chit like the old games, like in the 70s and 80s used to just have. It's just a little cardboard square with a name on it.
Yeah, I mean, I picked up Cosmic Encounter when I was in New York, and like, I mean, I could have picked up the old one here, but the old one was just like cardboard pieces, yeah. And the new one, needless to say, it's only small little plastic ships, but yeah. Those plastic ships make the hell of a difference in between the old one and the new
cooler.
One.
Yeah. More dynamic looking, I guess, on the...
It looks more interesting on a table.
Yep.
It brings us right back to Space Cadets. I think a game, if you're going to be spending the money you're going to be spending on games today, having the plastic figures in it...
So he wanted like a Barbie doll or something.
Yeah.
Wanted something to play with.
Exactly. I want something to do its hair. I want to do its hair. Now, having the plastic figures in there, it makes the game last longer, in my opinion. It makes it look better. It makes you feel like you got some artistic work for the money you paid. Right. Where somebody sat down with this idea and said, how can I make this idea the best idea ever? And what can make my game better than anyone else's out there? That's where Seven Wonders comes across. Zombicide comes across.
Well, Zombicide's expensive. I think the point for it is like, but it's do I make my game $100 and not have everyone buy it, or do I make a game that's really cool and thematic and it has a lot of theme to it, or it has a lot of a unique component to it, and sell it for $50? Or do we add miniatures and we're not sure how well it's going to do and sell it for $85 where no one wants to buy it?
Well, I feel, especially with Kickstarter now, a lot of the games that, you know, source their funding from that have become more commonly using miniatures because they can fund it ahead of time, you know? Like, obviously it's expensive and it's a lot of overhead for
they get an understanding of,
they can fund
is
it.
My game worth the miniatures?
Well, that's not even that. Like, Zombicide wasn't going to have miniatures. Like, they wanted miniatures, but... they got enough funding that they could do miniatures, which I think that's what most of the games with Kickstarter does, is this is my game, this is as cheap as I can produce it, I only need $25,000.
Yeah.
Holy shit, I got $75,000, I can make miniatures now. Sweet. And that's what most games did, that's what Salem did, it was all just going to be cardboard.
Have you played that yet?
No, it hasn't come in yet.
Okay.
And it got enough funding that they decided to make wooden pieces. So, I mean, that wasn't the plan, but he got enough money for it. Same thing with the Apocalypse. They were just going to use plastic generic zombies. The Apocalypse got enough funding that they made unique pieces. So I think the bonus for Kickstarter is if you have that much people behind you, you can do it. But for games that don't bother doing that or companies that already last, like, you have to decide, do I sell a $40 game or do I sell a $100 game?
Well, see, I think the thing comes down to consumer here is would the consumer prefer a cardboard cheaper game? Or would the consumer prefer a $100 game that has the miniatures? And I think the question here, as my personal stance, as a person who's already spent loads of money in other facets, a $100 game that's going to last me forever is something I'm really willing to do.
Well, it just creates a larger distance in between the casual gamer and someone who plays board games on a regular basis like we do, who do a podcast, you know, like... if a game's going to cost $100, I don't have a problem spending the $100 if it's got the proper tools. But if someone, you know, who's a casual board gamer, they don't give a flying shit if it's got plastic miniatures or not. If it's $20 and they can take it home and play it, they're going to buy it for $20.
And honestly, in reality, a lot of board gamers like impulse buying. Would you really bought Space Cadets if it had $100 written on it?
Probably not.
Exactly.
I think the only reason why I bought Space Cadets is because I remember listening to the Best of 2012 podcast, thanks to Dice Tower, and pretty much every single person was like, Space Cadets.
And
I think
that's a big difference.
Space Cadets.
Like, Ryan has impulse bought so many things from Clint that he wouldn't impulse buy a game for $100, but he'd impulse a game for $40 or $50.
Right.
Well, and, I mean, that's the difference. Like, Adventurers, impulse buy. Space Alert, impulse buy. Legends of Andor, kind of an impulse buy. Legendary, impulse buy. So, I mean, you know, there's all these games that sit at 60 or below, and you're like, it looks fun, it seems fun, I don't really want to research it, I like what it sounds like, I'm going to buy it.
Well, so, this brings up a whole new aspect, and I think we've all alluded to it, we haven't jumped on this, is the importance of a local game store, getting involved in a local game store, going up there, meeting new people, playing some of their board games and getting to know, because, for instance, Zombicide's a great example of this. Seeing Zombicide,
always comes back to Zombicide. The world revolves.
It's the only game
you've
ever
one out of four
played.
Games
I've
played.
Well, no, it's
played.
Not the only game.
Zombicide.
I've played a few board games.
I will say it was a very successful project that they did.
But my point of what it is was that's like the most expensive game I've purchased. That's why I'm coming bringing that. I cringed my teeth at that one even still, if I hadn't played it once with someone who already purchased it, I would never have gotten it.
And he
and
bought the way that dual land and he never played with
and,
it.
And this is an also addition that you add. It's like you bought the game for 90, 80 bucks, yeah. Really enjoyed it, and now you want to go home and you want to kick all the extra shit that's currently on Kickstarter for $150.
And I'm going to do that. Like, that's happening.
The only plus of seeing things is, I think, from Ryan and myself being here and Ethan and us playing games, is people get to see them and they get intrigued by them. I think we've probably honestly sold Zombicide like 9 times at Clint's store already.
Yeah.
And on top Shadows of that, Camelot.
Sean has been also getting a bunch of people to buy it too.
Yeah. And yeah. I mean, we
because it's an intriguing game. It's under 100 bucks and, you know, it's pretty easy for people to get in and play it. It takes less
co-op. And it's co-op. So you're working together to build, it almost builds friendships as you're going.
But right now zombies are the hottest thing on TV.
They're the hottest thing on TV, but they screw that license whenever they put it in a board game.
I think Zombicide could outlive the zombie fad. I think it could.
Well, the zombie fad is forever because it's going to happen one day. But
I mean, you know, if there was a good alien show on right now, then, you know, we might have more alien board games or something like that.
Yeah. Right.
You know, there's some good medieval. You know? Well, yeah. when Game of Thrones
comes
back. Then you'll
Game of Thrones
selling,
board
like,
games
Mage
were hot
Quest
and stuff like that because they do have, and they have Game of Thrones card game came out, the Living Card Game.
And that actually
hot.
Has gotten a pretty big following in Cincinnati now.
Yep.
The Living Card Game.
So,
hey, Mr. Hicks, I think demoed Descent here. We sold like 6 Descents. Yeah. I mean, seeing someone play the game and getting to see the mechanics definitely helps your decision.
Right. And to full circle that back into talking about, you know, miniature war games, which is the purpose of this segment we're filming right now. Like, it's intriguing to watch. It's intriguing to watch. Yeah, it does take a little bit more to explain the rules, but when you see people come in and play a war game and, you know, flip their shit all over.
Well, when you see the figure out there that demonstrates the monstrosity of the situation. Is not like
monstrosity.
But what I mean,
is
like
a Colossus on the field.
No, because what I mean, like, especially when we were playing stuff like Shadows of Camelot, and you actually saw the movement of the figurine that actually demonstrated the issue. I can look across the table, not knowing what's going on the board, and see that. Oh crap! They better hurry up over here. And that right there intrigues me to a game to saying, okay, there's something exciting here. But when you're playing something like...
So John says he has ADD and he can't pay attention to the whole game. That's what he's saying right now.
That's not what I'm saying, though, at all. Like, what I'm saying is the intrigue of seeing... Being able to decipher a game without being in the game really, I think, brings people into something like this.
On that note, we're going to leave you guys with open questions about John's remarks. So we're going to lead into our final segment, which hopefully is a quick one because we're running pretty low on time. The final segment, we are going to be discussing International Tabletop Day that occurs on March 30th. So we are going to wrap up the segment about wargaming with one question that each person is going to answer. And the question is circular bases or square bases? I vote circular bases. How about you, Chris?
Circular bases.
Clint?
What is this question relating to?
Just answer the fucking question.
Miniature, circular base, or square?
Large models in a circular base game would require ovals, so we'll go with oval.
Ovals. Oh, you're breaking the bounds. It's we're preparing for our Easter episode that's coming up, so egg shapes are pretty cool.
Circular bases all the way.
Hell yeah. Sorry, Warhammer, but circular bases are better. All right, we're going to lead into our next segment now.
So we're going to end the segment with talking about International Tabletop Day, which is March 30th. It's sponsored by Asmodee, Days of Wonder, Indie Board Games and Cards, and Steve Jackson.
Mayfair.
I said Mayfield, I think. I apologize. Well, this game was created based off the YouTube sensation of Tabletop, which is a show you can watch on YouTube with Will Witten and a special guest. Show is kind of cool, I guess, if you've never played board games and it intrigues you into it. And that's why they've made this day. What this day is about is really just gathering your friends, family, either going to your local hobby store to support it for that day, or just getting around and playing games and being more social. Because board games really does have a full aspect to it. It's teaching you stuff, it's teaching you co-op,
you know, math, etc. Basically anything that's in a field of learning, it all breaks it down. Brains. And it's, you know, communication skills, leadership, how to work together. There's tons of things that board games do and teach you, especially kids. And I think nowadays, I mean, I never played board games as a child, so I'm sure kids that are younger than us have never played a board game and don't even know what they are. I mean, I played Monopoly and Sorry and stuff, but I never played real board games. And I think this is just trying to get people back to, you know, you can still do something that's fun and be social, whether it's with your family or friends. You don't need to be sitting in front of the TV all day or playing video games and not going outside, even though board games really aren't going outside. It's still a social hobby. And I think that's what they're really pushing, is there's something else to do instead of sit on your phone or sit on the laptop or watch TV. It's really about just being together and playing something and doing something that you all enjoy. And they just really want to make this a day where everyone goes out and does this and either say thank you to their hobby store and just have a full day of fun.
Mm-hmm. Human interaction versus this stupid
words with
kid
friends
sitting next to me. You know, with your iPhone and your computer, you know. I mean, my family, we try to play board games at least once a week with the kids. Even my older kids, we always try to do that with them. I mean, they learn. It's like, you know, building a puzzle, you know. You learn how to do stuff, strategy, what, you know. There is luck in a lot of games with the dice and the card draw, but just social humor, human interaction where you're talking to people instead of typing crap back and forth to individual people that who knows if you will ever meet them or anything like that. And that's really, I think, what the game store is up here is all about. None of you guys knew each other before you came here.
Right.
No, I didn't know anybody, Ryan or anyone. I just literally came in.
And I mean, you know, some of these guys went to school with each other or were in school at the same time, grew up in the same city, but never met each other. But, you know, they all come in here and hang out. And, you know, now they have, you know, real friends. They go and do other stuff besides show up here and hang out and absorb my air and stuff like that. But,
you absorb your electricity.
Yeah, more like it.
And internet access, mainly. But, so, I mean, you know, it's a way to grow and, you know, enjoy other people instead of just through texting and stuff like that.
Critical thinking as a community.
I mean, in the world where we live in right now, where everything's built off a phone or a computer screen, you're absolutely right.
Well, even that, so many board game companies are coming up with fucking apps for their games now, too.
Which is, I actually think it's kind of cool.
John, you could shut up. Because the day that we show up and we all whoop our iPads out and we're just like, yeah,
let's play Catan
together. Let's web link right now. Like, we won't even look at each other. We'll have our webcams on at the same time. Like,
I saw the most expensive game of Monopoly of all time, where they had one iPad in the middle, and then it was six or four other people all with iPads playing on their iPad where it all showed up on the board in the middle. So it's five iPads.
That's a sin.
Yeah, it was
like
nuts.
Whoever invented that, hopefully they curl over and die choking on a metal spoon.
Well, you know, that was like the first PC computer actually replaced a deck of cards. And I don't know.
For solitaire.
Yeah. Solitaire, yeah. What does everybody play on it? Solitaire.
It also replaced a field of mines.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, you know, was always fun as a kid. Too.
You know, and you could have bought a deck of cards for a buck somewhere, and instead you spent $500 or $600. Yeah.
$4.
Unless you, Cincinnati, you know, based. Bought that, you know, IBM PC that could barely operate anything else.
Yeah, Solitaire and Oregon Trail.
Yeah.
You learned how to play cards, and you learned how to ride in a wagon across the country.
And die.
So applicable. Damn snake bites. Damn snake bites.
But see, like, in all of this, what we're doing to ourselves was we're building a wall.
Hold on. Are our listeners all on computers right now?
Yeah. They're on computers or iPhones, you know, streaming this.
Yeah.
So we won't completely hate on the technical age because obviously it's allowing us to talk to you guys as you sit at your jobs, you know, procrastinating, doing nothing.
Buy a newspaper.
Buy a newspaper. Learn about what's going on in the world. And, you know, the one thing you should know that's going on in the world is that on March 30th, we do have an awesome tabletop game. I don't know what people's work schedules are looking like, but I'm sure the clean-cut casual cast will be hanging out playing board games all day with Clint.
you know, probably watching shows on FX or sci-fi all day.
Walking Dead will be on in the evening.
Is it on a Sunday?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, so it's on a Sunday.
Saturday, done. I believe.
Game.
Saturday or Sunday? Sunday. It's Sunday. On a Sunday?
Sunday. Walking Dead's on Sunday nights.
So on a Sunday, a 10, really? I don't care what your excuses are.
Something like that.
You shouldn't be at work on a Sunday. It's the
March
day of...
March 30th is a Saturday.
So on the Saturday, you guys still shouldn't be at work anyway. So you know what you should do? You should come to Eastside Games and Cards. If it's too much of a commute, then I'd understand going to your other local shops. And I'm required to say this, and I have no problem saying it. If you live in the Brooklyn area, you better be going to 20 Sided Store. That place is totally fucking awesome. Extremely small shop, but man, it was super awesome sitting in there talking to Magic cards with people. And it's located in, like, the middle of nowhere in Brooklyn. It's, like, the shop of 20 Sided Store and then nothing else. So if you're in New York area, hit up that shop on March 30th. If you're anywhere else that's able to come to Cincinnati, you better be at Eastside Games and Cards, because that's where it's at.
And
it'll be a fun day of games.
If you don't know where local board games shop is, you can actually go to tabletopday.com, type in your zip code, and find one. If there's not one close to you, just sit around with your family and play a game. Doesn't matter if you're playing with deck of cards, Monopoly, sorry, whatever. Just something to be social that day. That's what brought me to board games. I played video games die hard for most of my life, and then I played a board game, and I was like, damn, this is like 100 times better than just sitting at my house playing a video game. There's an awesome social...
Eating Cheetos.
Well, I wish I could come here in my underwear and just play games.
And eat Cheetos.
What's up, Clint?
But no, in reality, like, it's, you know, video games are like, oh, I'll put a mic on and you can talk to these people that you're shooting with. Or, you know, I'd rather just come to a board game shop and
see everyone and socialize. You put up this wall of you can say whatever, you can do whatever there, and you don't learn real human interaction when you're actually having to look someone in the eyes and say, I'm going to go do this.
And you're cheating.
Yeah. You haven't learned life until you could look someone in the eyes, point the finger and say, you fucking cheater.
You also
get those pink 50s, you cheating whore.
Which John does a lot in War Machine.
We might have to crop that out for legal rights. I don't want Dane Cook coming in like hunting us down. Last thing we need is him coming in the door acting like a raptor or like a predator or whatever. Man. So, anyway, March 20th,
March
tabletop. 30th.
March 30th.
March.
Yeah.
God, fuck! I already fucking up.
It's too late.
It's getting too late.
So
March 30th. It's a Saturday. You guys should come out and play some games. More than likely, most of your shops will either have games on hand to play, or if you come to Eastside Games and Cards, which you should, there will probably be a large enough inventory just alone in between Clint and the Clean Cut Casual guys, because I think collectively we have like 300 and some odd board games. It's a sin.
Mostly Ryan's.
Mostly Ryan's. But more than likely, we will talk Ryan into attending.
Ryan is definitely trying to take off work to participate in this event, because this is his hobby. This is what he loves. It's his passion, obviously. I think everyone's seen that through his, you know, demoing Descent, wanting to demo Mercs, wanting to demo so many other things, Mage Wars, etc. Ryan loves introducing people to this hobby because it really is fascinating. And that's really what March 30th is about. Come down, hang out, socialize, realize how fun board games are.
And hopefully, I think these suppliers are supposed to send out to the local stores that are listed on there. On the website, hopefully some demos or promos for different games that they produce.
Yeah, promos would be really awesome. Kind of like additional materials for people to use as they try out games. You know, so March 30th.
And we have all facets too. Like, we'll probably be up here playing all facets, playing miniature games, playing board games, playing card games,
war games, magic, board games.
So I mean, like, it, whatever you're into. Come out March 30th.
Almost,
but yeah, we can play. Oh, I hear what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah. Leave the costumes at home. Please.
Yes, please.
No LARPing inside the store unless it's Bang.
Lightning Bolt.
Bang would be sweet.
Or Cash and Guns, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Cash and Guns. Yeah, you're right. All right, so on that note, March 30th, add it to your iPhones, your iPads, your laptops, and every other digital thing that you possibly own since
or
we hate
calendar.
It on it. Or your calendar if you have one at home. So we're now going to lead into the closing notes. All right, I want to thank everybody for joining
us for episode 4?
I think it's 4.
I'm pretty sure it's 4.
One says 3. I think four.
No, it's 4.
Yeah, you guys did.
So, thank you for joining us for episode 4. Hopefully, we will be returning to our regular bi-weekly schedule. Again, we apologize for the delay due to, you know,
work,
vacations, trip, work, real life, digital technology, etc., you know. So, without further ado, we shall end this relatively lengthy podcast for once. I'm Ethan Schultz.
Chris.
Clint.
John.
Again, I'd also like to extend a thank you to Andrew, who also joined us this evening, and along with Clint, the shop owner, and John, a good buddy of ours from many, many games, for an excellent podcast. We'll see you all in 2 weeks. Have a good one. Bye.